Dermatology Snapshots, March 2024, edited by Dr. Ferguson and Dr. Giad. Paper 1. Factors associated with early onset androgenetic alopecia. A scoping review. Liu et al. Plus 1. Why we chose this paper. Early onset androgenetic alopecia is known to be associated with some chronic conditions. It remains challenging to treat, and therefore identifying individuals who are at high risk and any potentially modifiable risk factors might help us advise our patients. Study aim and design. This review of case control, cross-sectional and meta-analysis included only androgenetic alopecia with onset before 40 years old, and where appropriate controls were used. Different scales to evaluate severity were commented on. What were the main findings? 65 papers, including 68% of case control design. A lot of studies were recent, after 2020, highlighting the recent interest in this. Many studies were from India. 78% of studies included males only. Some 43% defined early androgenetic alopecia as before 30 years old. Risk factors including family history of androgenetic alopecia, smoking, unhealthy diet and high BMI. Frequently reported comorbidities include metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, insulin resistance and dyslipidemia and Parkinson's disease. Limitations. Is it applicable? In the NHS, we rarely need to advise on male androgenetic alopecia, but the majority of data here is focused on that. Much of the data comes from non-UK study sites. We can't generalise from the data that improving your diet, stopping smoking, maintaining a healthy BMI might reduce the risk of developing androgenetic alopecia, but it's helpful to be aware of the correlation and to consider a holistic approach to the patient's general health when dealing with early onset androgenetic alopecia. What's the take-home message? Early onset androgenetic alopecia seems to be associated not only with family history, but also with smoking and metabolic risk factors such as BMI and diet. Paper 2. Results for treatment algorithm for generalized granuloma annulare. Bert Krause et al., Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper. There are multiple treatment options for granuloma annulare, a common condition. Study design and results. Based on retrospective case series, a treatment algorithm was proposed. First line, all patients were offered antimalarials. Narrowband GVB was offered instead of or in addition to antimalarials, according to patient preference, if lesions were photoprotected and a patch morphology. Topical anti-inflammatory medications and or intralesional triamcinolone were added for the treatment of isolated, symptomatic or thick lesions. An adjunct to first-line therapy included doxycycline and or pentoxifilin if patients received some response with first-line therapy or if a low-risk option was preferred. Second-line therapy. TNF inhibitors if previous treatments produced a less than desirable response. Dapsone, methotrexate and acitretin were used in select patients as an alternative to TNF inhibitors, but low response rates and high rates of medication-associated side effects led to a shift away from these therapies. Findings. Of 18 patients, 58.8% of patients on first-line treatments received a partial or complete response. Six with recalcitrant disease completely cleared with TNF inhibitors. Limitations, is it applicable? This was a retrospective small case series with no control group, limited results data. What's the take-home message? Authors of this paper, who have expertise in granulomatous disorders, lay out a simple two-step treatment algorithm. Whilst TNF inhibitors are suggested as second-line therapy, in the UK, use of this will be limited. Authors report a move away from traditional systemics due to side effects and low response rate. Paper 3. Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, a systematic review of treatment outcomes. Kaschetsky et al., Journal of the European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology. Why we chose this paper. Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation is common, especially in darker skin types, and patients are often desperate for a cure. Most people use topical therapies or combination therapies first line. Study aim and design. A systematic review with narrative summary of studies looking at partial, complete or lack of response to laser or topicals and peels or combination of treatments. What were the main findings? 41 studies, including 877 patients, were summarised. Rates of complete response were low, 18% with laser, 5% with topicals, 2% with combination therapy. Partial response was slightly better, 85% with combination therapy, 72% with topicals alone, 61% with laser, and 33% with peels. Notably, post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation worsened in 3% using laser. 10 patients using topicals reported side effects. Broad-spectrum photoprotection was only used in some studies despite good evidence for this. Topical therapies used with better responses included azelaic acid, vitamin C derivatives, retinoids and hydroquinone, but all only when used in combination with, e.g. laser or peels. Limitations, is it applicable? The vast majority included studies were looking at post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation secondary to acne, so applicability to other causes of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation is limited. Variable outcome measures were used, making it hard to combine the data. What's the take-home message? Most of us in the NHS are only able to offer topical therapies for post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, and even this is often restricted. But used alone, topicals are rarely particularly beneficial. Used alongside other modalities like lasers and peels, responses are better, but overall treatment options remain unsatisfactory. Paper 4. Nice updates. Difelikefalin is recommended with its marketing authorisation for treating moderate to severe pruritus in adults with chronic kidney disease having in-centre hemodialysis. We're very excited about this recent NICE guidance. Most of us will have struggled considerably with managing renal pruritus. Difelikefalin is a selective GABA opioid receptor agonist that has shown promising results in trials. Note it's to be prescribed by renal physicians, and we can start to make recommendations to our renal colleagues for patients with pruritus recalcitrant to dermatological treatments. Ritlecitinib for treating severe alopecia areata in people 12 years and over. We imagine that most dermatologists will have already received inquiries about this. This drug was not recommended by NICE's Independent Appraisals Committee in September 2023, but following a public consultation and the company providing additional information and an improved discount to its price, the treatment is now recommended as clinically and cost-effective for use in the NHS. The technology appraisal is due to be published imminently. Qualifying criteria and the expansion of biologic treatments in dermatology will need to be navigated. Paper 5. Anti-SSA antibody is a potential predictor of severe Stevens-Johnson syndrome and toxic epidermal necrolysis, a retrospective cohort study. Watanabe et al., Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Who doesn't like a good biomarker? This was a sizeable retrospective study. 64 patients with Stevens-Johnson syndrome, N equals 37. Stevens-Johnson's TN overlap, N equals 5. Or TN, N equals 22. Anti-SSA, which is familiar to us for autoimmune testing, has two target proteins, namely Rho52 and Rho60.2. The anti-SSA detected in this study was anti-Rho60. Four patients had a history of autoimmune diseases associated with anti-SSA or anti-nuclear antibody production prior to Stevens-Johnson TNO onset. 13 patients tested positive for anti-SSA at Stevens-Johnson TN onset. Anti-SSA positivity in titers was significantly higher in patients with Stevens-Johnson TN overlap and TN than in those with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Anti-SSA positivity was also identified as a predictor of poor outcomes. Sequential samples obtained from 9 patients after recovery were analysed to determine whether the anti-SSA levels were episodic or persistent. All patients except for one with Stevens-Johnson syndrome, accompanied by systemic lupus erythematosus, exhibited significantly decreased anti-SSA levels after recovery. Anti-SSA, a widely available test, may be a predictive indicator of poor outcomes in patients with Stevens-Johnson TEN.